the duties of a snataka. So 10.3, rules of good conduct. So personal appearance: keeping his hair, nails, and beard clipped, subduing his passions by austerities, wearing white garments and keeping himself pure, he shall always engage in studying the Veda and such acts as are conducive to his welfare. So here is that the grihastha has to be tidy. You know, that is one of the principles here. You know, his hair, his nails, beard. Clipped here basically means his hair. Clipped means it's either cut short, or here generally it means shaved, like that. Because Brahmins, they always keep shaved heads. That's generally their principle. So in other words, they're tidy. The passions are subdued. They wear white, you know, so simple. Because then you don't have to worry. You know, it's just, you don't have to worry about what you're going to wear today. You know, if you're going to be in fashion or not, or this or that. You just wear your white clothes and it works. It's always, that's the nice thing about it. It's very simple. Studying the Veda and what's good for his welfare means what's good for his elevation, his purity, his development. That has to be seen. Like that. So in other words, there is that. In other words, his body is his pure. What he wears is simple and pure. His mentality is pure, and his endeavors are pure. So the body, the mind, the words, everything's pure. So that's the idea. Many times we think grihastha life means, Prabhupada says, it's a license for sense gratification. But this doesn't mean that purity is not the principle. Probably gives that point. Purity is the force. So it's because purity is there, then everything else works. There's power behind it. There's no purity. The power just doesn't, not there. It just doesn't function. Like that, it would be reduced. So the greater the purity, the more the power. Like it said, someone who's a, you know, brahmachari, who's been trained, you know, as raised as a brahmachari and always been pure, then just when they speak, it will influence people. Like that. They just have so much influence. Like that. Just by brahmacharya. So that's the point, is that purity, that creates the force. So, passions by austerity. So for a Brahmin, he needs to study the Veda. You're studying the Veda and acts are conducive as welfare. That's his austerities. Like that. Chanting the holy name and studying the Veda. These are his austerities. And then naturally then he will teach this. Residence. Let him not dwell in a village where the sacred law is not obeyed, nor stay long where diseases are endemic. Let him not go alone on a journey, nor reside long on a mountain. And so he shouldn't stay in a place that's there's not good association. He shouldn't be alone and no association. Because otherwise then if the sacred law is not obeyed in that place or in his circle that he moves in, then his association, his only association, will be those who don't follow the sacred law. And so then because of this, naturally, then he'll have a tendency to be lax in following the law. In the sense it mentions in the first chapter, that the Brahman is born to fulfill the law. He's to practice it, he's to study it, he's to practice it, he's to teach it. Like that. The Brahman is born to ensure that the law goes on. So that's his duty, like that. The kshatriyas they'll enforce it, but they won't know what to enforce unless they're taught it by the Brahmins. So that's, you know, his austerity, is that studying of the Veda, practicing the Veda, teaching the Veda. So if he does that, then he's considered perfectly austere. And if he doesn't have good association, how to maintain that? So that's the point here. There where diseases are endemic, where it's always disease happening. Because a Brahmin can't expose himself to dangers. That's the thing, is that others may. Kshatriyas may put themselves in a dangerous situation. You know, that's the meaning of battle, of war. The Brahmins don't, because they can't be responsible for killing the Brahmin. Right? So by their neglect and a Brahmin is killed, then that is not good. Does that make some sense? So that's why you always see it come up again and again. He can't do things that may create some injury to himself. Like that. Right? Should not go alone on the journey, that's also unsafe. Should always go with others. Right? The sannyasis may go along alone, the hermits may go alone. Because their point is they're not worried if they live or die. You know. But Grihastha, he's to live and fulfill the sacred law. That's his duty. And not reside long on a mountain. One is you'll be very far away from the other civilization where you can be benefit for them. Two, it's more dangerous on the mountain. Like that. You know, so many things live on the mountain. You know, like that. Let him not dwell in a country where the rulers are Shudras, nor one in which is surrounded by unrighteous men, nor in one which has become subject to heretics, nor in one swarming with men of the lowest castes. So in other words, you should always be in a place that has good association. That's very important. You know, so this that personal appearance is that he's pure in his body, mind, and words, and then in his residence he stays in a place where there's good association. Like that. Then 10.3.3, study of the Veda. Let him wake in the Muhurta sacred to Brahman and think of the acquisition of spiritual merit and wealth and of the bodily fatigue arising therefrom and of the true meaning of the Veda. So the Muhurta sacred to Brahman is the Brahma Muhurta. So he should be up at that time and then he should be performing. He should be studying. He should be performing sadhana. Or like we follow Pancharatra, so therefore then we attend Mangalarti. Like that. So in any case, whatever is the sadhana, being up in the Brahma Muhurta, that's the Vedic standard. Like even the musicians, they practice music, they have to be playing during the Brahma Muhurta. They can't. If you go to a good music school, they're always playing during the Brahma Muhurta. Whatever you want to perfect in your life, you do it during the Brahma Muhurta. So that's why a Brahman, he wakes up in the Brahma Muhurta, or a human being wakes up in the Brahma Muhurta and contemplates these things. Spiritual merit, wealth, you know, means his, in other words, his occupational performances, because that will get him wealth. But he must contemplate the bodily fatigue arising from that. That he's making that endeavor, but it's also very wearying. So then the question always arises, is it worth it to make the endeavor for so much wealth? So that way then he'll always keep his life as simple as possible. Because if he gets too tired, then so much more time will come out of his spiritual activities, out of his sadhana, out of his study, out of his teaching, out of his preaching. When he has risen, has relieved the necessities of nature, and carefully purified himself, let him stand during the morning twilight, muttering for a long time the Gayatri, and in the proper time he must similarly perform the evening devotion. By prolonging the twilight devotions, the sages obtain long life, wisdom, honor, fame, and excellence in Vedic knowledge. So in the Vedic culture, then chanting of the Gayatri, that is the japa. So they don't just chant, you know, 10 mantras. Right? We do that, that's Pancharatra position. Because for us, we have a mantra that we chant as japa. Because that's the thing, in the Pancharatra, you have japa. Then you have your mantras that are used for your deity worship. Does that make sense? Like that. So we have Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And we have Gayatris that go with the particular deities that we worship. So that's the Pancharatric system. Vedic system is everybody just chants Brahma Gayatri. And by that, they'll chant it 108 or 1008 or more, whatever they like. So that's how they chant it. That's their japa. So in here, whenever it's talking like this about performing for a long time, it means that chanting the holy name, that should be done. So by that, then sages obtain long life, wisdom, honor, fame, and excellence in Vedic learning. So we see is that Manu is also pointing out that japa is very, very important. Chanting the holy name is very important. It's actually the essence of the whole Vedic culture. Is that... Mm-hmm. Why the difference? Because pancharatra then is ekayana, so it's focused only on Vishnu. So you'll have a Vishnu mantra that you chant japa with, and then because you're worshipping the deity, you have these various gayatris. You know, and Brahma Gayatri is a separate thing. Brahma Gayatri is Vedic. So for us, Brahma Gayatri is not our japa. So it just goes in with the pancharatric mantras. Because basically in Kali Yuga, most people qualify themselves to accept the Vedic initiation because of the pancharatric. Like that. Because in Kali Yuga, everyone's born Shudras. So Shudras don't take Upanayana. They don't accept the Brahma Gayatri. So by the process of the pancharatra, that pancharatric initiation, the body changes. So then you're reborn. You know, so that rebirth, now you're born as devotees, so therefore devotees are Brahmins. Then you're entitled to the Brahma Gayatri. And for the pancharatra to work in Kali Yuga, then you have to have the holy name. Otherwise it doesn't function. Like that. Without the Bhagavat, the pancharatra, because in this age the Bhagavat is the primary. Pancharatra is secondary. Pancharatra is for Dwapara Yuga. That's the primary, because it includes, it already has japa in it, it has hearing the Bhagavatam, it has, in other words, everything's there, it's just, you take these five main principles and then you just change the which one's prominent. You know, like in deity worship, then you have meditation, dhyana, manasa puja, like that. So that becomes prominent in the satya yuga. Or after worshipping the deity, then you do yajna with the deity Mula Mata. So that becomes prominent in the Treta Yuga. Right? And the Pancharatra, the whole system becomes prominent in Dwapara. And in Kali Yuga, then the Namasankirtan. So they're all part of the same system. Ekayana means what is Vedic that's only focused on Vishnu, nothing else. That's what's Pancharatra. Like that. Well, Vedic is general, because anybody can take it up. Like you see, you go to a Shaivite's house, you go to a Vaishnav's house, or someone who's a Krishna Bhakta, someone who's a Ram Bhakta, you know, someone who's a Tantric. You go to their house, and the culture will be the same. You know, some slight deities are the same. You know, they'll all eat with their right hand, all serve in the same way. It doesn't matter. The richest house, the poorest house, doesn't matter what community, what state it's in, what their deity is, you'll see there'll be a consistency in the culture. So that's what's common. Philosophy will be different. But even the philosophy is based on the Veda, and the Veda comes from Krishna. So technically there should be a commonality, because they all accept certain basic principles. So someone who accepts only the Veda, then all other literatures are put in line with the Veda. Therefore it's just like, we will classify the Gandharva Veda, Atharva Veda, I mean Gandharva Veda, Ayurveda, Dhanurveda and Staphanaveda as Upapurana, as branches of Purana. That's how we categorize it. But Vedic tradition, for those who only accept Veda, then they're connected with the Vedas. Like that. So that way you can connect everything there. It means your Brahmanas, from that you get your the Brahmanas, then have the Griya Sutras and the Dharma Sutras. So the Griya Sutras will give rise to Kalpa, which is all the ritual. And the Dharma Sutras will give rise to the Dharma Shastra. Like that. You know, then your Upavedas all go there, your Purana is the fifth Veda. So basically all those Mimamsa is an explanation of the Veda. What is your particular interpretation, or what's your angle on the Veda? That's Mimamsa. Like that. Then Sanskrit is just, it's the language, so you have to know Sanskrit. So that comes in Siksha. Siksha Chanda Vyakaran Nirukta. Those are all Vedangas. So there. So between the Veda and the Vedangas, everything else fits in. So that's just the Vedic angle on it. As we call it, Pancharatra. You know, so for us, the Smriti is actually more prominent for us than the Shruti. So then it becomes categorized in a different way. You know, it's just they become separate subjects. Veda is Veda. And then these others are their own book. So it's just a matter of how you look at it. It's the same thing. Does that make sense? It's just like, let's say, in a meal, then your rice, your vegetables, your dals, these things are the more prominent. And then that's enhanced with the sweets and the salties and chutneys and like that. But let's say you're having a snack, right? Then your sweets and those special salty peppers, those become prominent. And other things are reduced or even removed. You understand? Because it's a snack. Or a breakfast has same elements, but other things come out. Like you could in a lunch put fruit, but many times you wouldn't because it mixing with the fruit, the salties is hard to digest. But at breakfast, fruit becomes more prominent. Fruit comes out, milk comes out more. Like that, salty becomes little. Like that. But in lunch, then it's the other way around. So it just depends upon what is the purpose and all that. Then the proportion of all these different items is different. But otherwise it's the same. And that's the important thing, is that everything is there. So in the Vedic literatures, in the Vedic culture. So then if you know all these things, then it works for you. If you don't know, it doesn't work. Then it becomes a rule that it's something new or something different. You become enamored by it. You know, sometimes devotees get enamored by astrology or Vastu or, you know, Sanskrit or Ayurveda, or, you know, and they somehow take that as more prominent. But those are all just various branches of the Veda. The real purpose of the Veda is your mimamsa. What is your philosophy? How do you interpret it? And your culture, how you're going to live it. And all these are just part of that. You know, Sanskrit is so you understand the Shastras. Ayurveda is so you can maintain your health. Jyotish is simply so that you know what are the proper auspicious times to perform proper activities. Like otherwise, how do you know when's Ekadasi? Right? Or when Janmashtami is going to be? It's by astrology and astronomy. Specifically astronomy. Astrology is more for interpreting, you know, for marriage, what's compatible for marriage, or like that. Trying to see the nature of the child for the training. Like this. And it can be used for those who are having interest then to figure out how they're going to become rich and wealthy and famous in the future, and, you know, all these kind of things. Probably mentions that. For those who are more materialistic, then those items become more prominent. Okay. But the whole point is they're just all parts of the actual thing, which is living the philosophy. That's the main thing. Living the philosophy, that's the main item that's there. Personal behavior. Let him not show particular attention to an enemy, to the friend of an enemy, to a wicked man, to a thief, or to the wife of another man. For in this world there is nothing so detrimental to long life as criminal conversation with another man's wife. Okay? So all these are going to give you trouble. Show particular attention to an enemy, because an enemy will wonder why. Right? Because people don't do anything unless they're going to get a result. So then the enemy wants to know what's the result. Why is he paying attention? You know, it's not just because you're a nice guy. Okay, you can do that, but the enemy is not going to think that you're a nice guy. That's what Krishna points out to Arjuna. Okay, you're the nice guy. Okay, you don't want to have this war, and that you want to let Duryodhana have the kingdom. Fine. But they're not going to see it that you're just kind and compassionate and see why he's such a avaricious person, and he doesn't mind killing everybody to get his means, but we're not like that. We see the wrong in it, so therefore we're not doing it. He'll just see that you're a coward, that's all. In other words, it takes good qualities to see good qualities. Right? Eyes see light, not your fingers. Right? Fingers touch. Because the quality of sensation, of touch, is in the fingers, not in the eyes. So therefore, they can touch, they can feel. Right? So there's air in the skin. There's touch. But there's fire in the eyes, so you can see. Does that make sense? So that's the point. Unless you have good qualities, you can't see good qualities. You know? So therefore, one shouldn't pay too much attention to the enemy or the friend of the enemy, because then the enemy will think, why, you know, why he's so friendly with my friend? Maybe he's trying to create some politics here. Right? A wicked man, you're nice to him, he'll just take advantage. Like that. A thief, you get friendly with him and he'll just steal from you. He'll get your confidence, he'll steal from you. And the wife of another man, because one, then everybody is very careful about that. Pay too much attention, and then they're going to then naturally think something's going on. So there's nothing so detrimental as criminal conversation with another man's wife. It means conversation that shouldn't be happening. If that happens, then it's bad. That will always create problems. Always create problems. Let him desire his prosperity, indeed, never despise a kshatriya, a snake, and a learned Brahmin, be they ever so feeble. Right? Because we see is that so many times is that because of their nature, then you have problems. Right? They're not just ordinary people. They may be feeble, so the ordinary person, they may be feeble. So you can harass them and they'll be intimidated, so they won't bother you back. Right? But not these three. Kshatriya, even though he's small, he may be young, he may be not strong at the time, his kingdom is weak, or he doesn't have an army, something is wrong. But it doesn't mean he's not going to get you. Like that. When he has the facility, when he has the army, then he'll remember you. Like that. Snakes also. You may get them this time, but next time when they find you, they'll get you. Like that.
Kshatriyas also need some administrative person to face administrative position or manager.
Here kshatriya means the kshatriya himself. Like that. His assistants, still you should be careful because they're kind of in a similar mood. Because Brahmins are forgiving, kshatriyas are not or are snakes. But at the same time, if a Brahmin feels that even though what you've done to him, personally he may forgive you, he may not forgive you for breaking the rule. Right? So he may try to correct you for the rule. There's nothing personal. So one has to be careful. Same time as the Vaishnava culture generally is forgiving, so then all these things are dropped. You know, just like in before. It's the same here. Is Vaishnava may not have enemies, but there are people who consider themselves enemies. Like Yudhishthira has no enemies, but since Duryodhana considers himself an enemy, therefore Yudhishthira will be careful with him. You never see Yudhishthira just hanging out with Duryodhana. You know, you never hear him even, except at certain times in the battlefield or here and there, talking to him. You just don't hear him. They don't talk. They don't. They just don't interact. You hear them talking with Dhritarashtra or Drona or Bhishma or Vidura, but you don't hear him talk. He doesn't talk to Shakuni, Karna, Dushasan, Duryodhana. He just doesn't talk to them. You know, he just doesn't. There's no. It's just the way it is. Because the point is this is niti. It's just the way it is. You know, it's like saying, don't stick your finger in water, it'll get wet. And you can't say, well, we're devotees, we can stick our hand in the water, we won't get wet. No, we get wet anyway. It's just the way it works. Because these three, when treated with disrespect, may utterly destroy him. Hence, the wise man must never despise them. You know, we see is that the kshatriya is then that's natural. You know, you make trouble for them, and when they get powerful, then you'll get trouble. But at the same time, Brahmins, then we see that so many have changed so many things. Right, the fire eats so many things simply because of a Brahmin. The water, the ocean is salty because of Brahmins. Like this. There's so many like this curses by Brahmins. And so one doesn't mess with Brahmins. That's just the principle. It's just otherwise you got trouble. Generally, they don't get easily upset. But if you do bring one to the point of getting upset, then you have yourself a problem. Like that. You know, it's just like you see Augustine. He drank the ocean. It was the whole ocean. There wasn't an ocean. So they had to get it back. Like that. Or like Janu. You have Janubri. Janavi was coming. Down the Ganga was coming. And she came roaring through his ashram. So he's just having, you know, his ashram's there. Things are going peaceful and nice. They're doing the yajna and the sadhana and study and teaching. And then suddenly this river comes roaring in. You know, and Ganga is not a small river. So then he just swallows her up. That's it. Finished. And goes about peacefully doing his duties. You know, and then you have... What's his name? Bhagirath Maharaj, yeah, he's driving ahead in his chariot and all that, and suddenly notices there's no sound. Turns around, there is no Ganga, there's just this peaceful ashram. Thinking, what happened here? And they go back and they find out that Janamuni, he was not very pleased. But then, you know, after Bhagirath Maharaj showed, you know, his sincerity and all that, then he let it, I think she came out of, oh, it came out of his ear, right? I think she came out of his ear. Like that, I think so. Came out of his ear, so that's why she's known as Janami. Because she's born from Jana. Because otherwise she was already appeared. She was born by the kick of, from the toe of Vishnu, but then he swallowed her up, so that's it. She's no more. So then, again, he manifests her now. So therefore she's known as Janami. Yeah, so that's his point, is don't take lightly Brahmins. Let him not despise himself on account of former failures. Until death, let him seek fortune, not despairing of gaining it. So one's failed formally, but if one sits around and, oh, I'm so useless, and this, and that, one, it's self-centered, two, it's a mode of ignorance, you know, and you won't be progressive. The point is you failed, so try again. Like you don't see little babies when they first time they get up on their feet, you know, generally they fall right over, or they get one or two steps, and you know they're either, you know, on their face or, you know, on their back, something. So they don't despise themselves; they just pick themselves up, do it again and again and again until they're walking. So that's the system. That's the system. If you despise yourself, how you move forward? Because ignorance is unprogressive. So you don't despise. You learn from your mistakes. You're not foolish. Mode of passion is you make an endeavor, it doesn't work, and you don't care. That's mode of passion. Because you don't care, because you don't continue. Mode of goodness is you keep going without despising yourself. So there's a... One is you just endeavored to try to get. You didn't get it. What to do? You know, like giving up a duty that you don't like to do because it's trouble. Then that's motive passion. Right? So here it's if you continue doing it, then it works. Right? Otherwise, then it's passion. That you stop just because, okay, we tried, didn't work. But it has to be, okay, this is not my duty, or it can't be done, or it has to be later, or, I mean, in that sense, it has to be part of the, has to be coming from Shastra. Practical, but from Shastra. But it was just a matter you tried, it didn't work, and so you see it's too much trouble, so you give it up. That's mode of passion. Okay. And mode of ignorance, and he'll despise himself. Until death, let him seek fortune, not despairing of gaining it. In other words, it's said that you seek fortune as if you're going to live forever. Right? And you perform sadhana as if you're going to die immediately. Does that make sense? Because if you think I'm going to die in the next moment, you won't endeavor for any development. And if you think I'm going to live forever, you're not going to get into your sadhana. Right? We had one, yeah. But, does that make sense? It's not an uncommon thing. Someone thinks he's going to die, he becomes very serious, very focused, and all this and that. And then somehow or another, you know, with time, the doctors can make tests and all that, and says, oh, yeah, now you're better. You're going to live for another 25 years. Many times, bang, they just drop their sadhana. Because the impetus for the sadhana is simply because I'm going to die. So you take it more seriously. I can see many devotees do. You know, they're not so serious, and then when they find out that, you know, things are getting terminally ill, then they find they move into the temple, they take up association devotees, they become more forgiving, broad-minded, philosophical. It's natural. Because then you just see the seriousness of it. Like that. So that's the method. Let him say what is true, let him say what is pleasing. Let him utter no disagreeable truth, and let him utter no agreeable falsehood. That is the eternal law. In other words, he should speak what is truthful in a pleasant way. That's the rule. Right? But it shouldn't be mixed. It shouldn't be, it's true, but it's unpleasant. You can't say a truth in a bad way. That's improper. And you can't say a pleasing falsehood. So it must be it pleasingly true. And of course, then it doesn't even goes without saying that a unagreeable falsehood is never spoken. That option is not even addressed. What is well, let him call well, or let him say well only. Let him not engage in a useless enmity or dispute with anyone. It means if it's good, let him say it's good. You know, or if he doesn't want to get into it, then it's nice. He doesn't have to get all elated about it, right? You're not elated in happiness. Or, you know, disturbed, depressed in distress. You know, it's just good things happen, it's nice. If bad things happen, what can you do? You know? So, in other words, you shouldn't be just saying something's good for political purposes or economic gain. Means if it's good, then he says it's good. It's not good, he doesn't say. You know, if he's being pressurized, then it's nice. You know, he doesn't have to make a show. That's the point of agreeable falsehood. Let him not insult those who have redundant limbs or deficient limbs, nor those destitute of knowledge, nor very aged men, nor those who have no beauty, nor wealth, nor those who are of low birth. Because when he travels, because Asnatic travels, and in this traveling he does many things, he's going to come across all kinds of people. So he should never then insult these persons, just because his position is better. His birth is good, his knowledge is there, his piety is there, so his physical beauty is there, his health is there, all these different things may be there. So he shouldn't criticize those who don't have. Like that. It's just one, it's useless because you can't tell by that. It means anything that is there that is not good is from previous sin. But everybody's got some. It's just where it falls. So you find very sinful people, mentality, who are extremely beautiful. You know, that's all they have left. Their only piety is all gone into the beauty. Or you have very, very nice people who aren't beautiful. Like that. And it's, you know, it's common, we'll always take this, that a sinful person would be not beautiful. And a very beautiful person would be pious. It's just automatically the thing, the natural thing. But it doesn't always work, because sometimes you have, like, let's say, Astavakra Muni. He was bent in eight places, but a great sage. You know? So it's not an uncommon thing like that. That they may not be beautiful like that. Especially Brahmins may be beautiful, may not be. Because if Vata is as prominent in their constitution, as many times it is, Vata means everything's crooked, nothing's straight. Teeth are crooked, you know, knuckles are funny, you know, the body's not straight. It's always bent. It's always, that's just the way it is. Passion, Pitta will give better shape. Better shaped form and that balance. Kapha will give very nice looking, fine skin, large eyes, you know, all those things that we take as very beautiful. like that. Therefore, you see, like the Kshatriyas, the emperors, and that they'd be a balance of the three. So they would have all the, you know, physical beauty of all these things. They have the quick mind of the Vata, you know, but they'd have the memory of the Kapha, like that. And they'd have the activeness of the Vata, but they would have the beauty of the Kapha, you know, and they would have the stableness and steadiness and drive of the Pitta, like this. So then all the qualities would be there. Like you see, Radha means, these are just reflections of what are the eternal principles. Like Radha and Krishna, they all have very large eyes. So that in the material world you can copy, but they have super sharp intelligence. You know, they always play word games. That's the prominent thing that they do. So that's called chala. So chala, it's a thing of nyaya, where somebody says a word, you take the word and you use a synonym of it. Or you change its meaning. You know, just like you have words, I forget what they're called. They have, is it homophone? I forget what it is. It means it has the same sound, but it has different meaning. Like you have four. Like four means before. Four means who it's to go to. Or four means the number four. So it's pronounced the same, but it has three different meanings. So like that you can deal on it. Is that you take the alternate meaning that's not in the context, and then you change the whole context of what someone says. You know, like Krishna, that famous one of Krishna. Radharani asked Krishna, where did you spend the night? You know, and so she says, where is your residence? And so he says, my residence is in your eyes. You know, he changes the whole meaning. She meant residence meaning where he stayed, where he spent the night last night. And what he was saying is where his heart is, or where his mood is. And then she says again, no, I said, and then she says, where do you spend the night? But the Sanskrit is there, and he broke the word, so it meant that night stole him. You know? So then so how would the night be able to steal us? You know? And so I think the first one is something about fragrance or something. He says, I've taken on this fragrance just to associate with you. Then it came the night thing. No, where's your residence? So she changed the word. Then he did chala on that. And then says, in your eye, like this. And they just go on and on. And sometimes they do this long time. They have pages and pages. They just go on and with this chala. You know, because someone will use one word and he changes the meaning, and then the word that has been used to that's been the synonym or another meaning, then they'll take that and then change that. So each one keeps changing on the other one what they're doing. And that, so you just, so that takes sharp intelligence to do. So you see, they have all these, the qualities are there. All it is the material world is a reflection of their qualities. So that the qualities run perfectly, therefore then, this is how it works. Like Krishna, he does like that. Someone's an enemy, he is not close with an enemy or friends with an enemy. He was neither friendly with Jarasandha or Shishupal, but they were great friends. Right? So, like that, it's just the way God is. So that's the whole idea. Manusamita is the way God is. What is his culture and the people he lives with? How do they behave? This is it. You know, that's all. Because we don't know what's a culture. So therefore it's written down here. But it's written in such a way that in the spiritual world, God and all his associates are all God. It means God conscious, right? Even God's conscious of God, right? So I guess, you know, like I said, Dorothy wakes up in the morning and meditates on himself, right? So he's God conscious. Right? Yeah, that would be an example of chala. You just change the meaning. So but in the material world, people aren't God conscious, but it's not that they shouldn't follow the same culture. Because they follow the Veda, which is coming from God, the philosophy is coming from God, but their interpretation of it, that's what can differ. But it shouldn't be that the culture they follow then changes, so that if you change your philosophy, you have to change culture, right? Like you see, if you're already following the Vedic culture, but let's say you're worshipping Shiva, then someone convinces you that worship of Vishnu is higher. Your culture stays the same. So all it is now, instead of you surrendering to your guru who's teaching you Shaivism, now you surrender to who's teaching you Vaishnavism. You're already studying scriptures, now you study the Vaishnava scriptures. You're already eating remnants of Shiva, now you're eating remnants of Vishnu. Right? You're already following your, you know, marriage ceremonies and all that, rituals of that scripture that are authorized in that particular line, sampradaya of that, now you do it in this. So basically everything is the same. Does that make some sense? And it doesn't, and also on these aspects of ritual, it doesn't matter. It means it doesn't matter what your philosophy, you follow one of the four Vedas. So you may be Vaishnava, you may be not, but you follow the Vedas. So that's stable. So that doesn't matter. Those things don't change. Your rituals basically don't change anything. You know, you're from a particular community, you're going to eat in the same way. A Gujarati who's a devotee of Krishna, a Gujarati who's a devotee of Ram, they eat the same thing. You know, they cook in the same way. It's not going to change. Does this make sense? So that's why the culture is there. It's God's culture. But it's written from the angle that you can take up one of six angles of vision on what the Veda means. Like that, and still follow the Vedic culture. Right? That's the six philosophies, yeah. Like that. So you may be into bhakti, you may be into impersonalism, you may be into karmakanda, you may be into yoga, you may be into science, you may be into logic. These may be your reasons. You know? But in any case, your culture is the same. So if someone defeats you in your philosophy and establishes in your mind that Vaishnavism is the better option, your culture stays the same. You know, it's not that then the guy goes home and tells his wife, okay, you know, throw out all this and that and all, now we have to go out and rebuy everything. No, it stays the same. That's the beauty of it. So the natural thing is just to be used for bhakti to please the Lord. But it can be used otherwise. But still, the dictates keep it within the Vedic culture. So even though you are following a path that's not Vaishnava, still it doesn't. You culturally don't disturb other people. You know what I'm saying? You can still tell if a Brahmin is a Shaivite or a Vaishnava. You can still tell the Brahmins because they were following the Vedic culture, wearing the dhoti, wearing white, keeping their hair and beard and nails clipped. Being pure, studying the scriptures, right? They have to, if they're doing worship, they have to keep a sikha, they have to do all these things. The only difference is in their tilak, or maybe the kind of beads they wear or something, or the color, you know, like that. Does that make some sense? But you can still tell he's a Brahmin. You know, because it's just there. Just like in India, sadhus. You have so many different kinds of sannyasis, but you can all tell the sadhus. You know? Like that. Either by the style of cloth they wear, the color of cloth they wear, or, you know, there's certain elements that are there, they're within it, and they pick and choose as they like. Like it says, the brahmachari, he can either shave his head completely, leave his hair unmatted, or keep a sikha. These are the three options for a brahmachari. So depending upon what your mood is, if you're an impersonalist, you shave your head because you do no ritual. Right? If you're just following the Vedic general, you're going to become a karmakandi, then you leave all your hair. But if you're doing worship of Vishnu or some kind of puja or connected with Pancharatri, you keep a sikha. Right? So that's what we follow. Right? So just depends what. So those three are there. So if you see any one of those three, along with the deer skin and the staff and all, then you know it's a brahmachari. Sannyasi always shaves his head. Like that, the cloth will be different. You know, he's not wearing a deer skin. So then you know it's a sannyasi. Like that. Yogis, and they keep their hair. Like that.
understand such culture, he can appreciate any culture which is manifested by other like Muslim cultures. So, that's why you know, traditional Indian different groups of spiritual people, they appreciate, they can peacefully live with Muslims or Christians.
It means culture is culture. It means that if you have culture, then you can appreciate other. Of course, there may be more development of culture in the Vedic system than non-Vedic. Because the point is the Vedic system is being given to the great sages. The non-Vedic are given to the Mulechas and Yavanas. You know what I'm saying? Those who are not following the Vedic culture are given the non-Vedic religions. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Only exception would be, I think, Jainism and Buddhism. People who were following Vedic culture, then take those up. Like that. So the idea is one can appreciate what's good there, but then the amount of it, it's just like, let's say, someone who's educated can appreciate primary, you know, nursery, primary, and secondary education. Right? But the thing is you still can't compare it to, you know, you can't compare the primary to the secondary, or the secondary to the undergraduate, the graduate to postgraduate. Like that. It's the same principle. Religion is religion, right? It's following the laws of God, because religion has to come from God. So that, just the question is just, how much does the religion go into detail to engage your whole life? Right? You know, like the question would be, as a devout Christian, what would you eat? What is the food of a Christian? What is Christian food? Is there such a thing? No. If you say, well, bread and wine and this and that, no, that's Jewish food. Because we always have to remember, Christ was Jewish. So they threw that all out. So then what? So there is no such thing as Christian food. There is no such thing as Christian dress. There is no such thing as Christian eating or sleeping or mating. There isn't. They don't have it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. As defined in this, it's not there. It doesn't deal with it. So therefore, but it teaches one how to be moral and nice and, basically a decent person. You know, and a God-fearing person. That's what it teaches. It doesn't teach beyond that. The Old Testament teaches you things. You know, as it is today, you have the Hasidic Jews. And they always are debating over, like, what kind of underwear is actually, you know, Talmudic underwear and stuff like that. You know, so whether the hat should fit on your head or not, or, you know, stuff like that. They argue over. But other than that, then it's just, so they have some degree is there in Islam, you know, because of the, they were dealing with people who were following a culture, right? Then they were dealing with the Jews for the rabbinical culture. But Christianity, as we know it, is scriptures that were written for pagans who were non-Jews. They weren't Asians, so they didn't have that kind of they didn't have the leftover culture that was still intact from the Vedic. You know, some remnants. You know, they weren't the Arabs. You know, they were they were just the common people of the tribals of Europe, which were too far removed. You don't really find much trace of the Vedic culture there. Like that. And the Celts, yes, but the Celts were gone by the time these people came. You know? And probably anything that was there, actually, probably your Christian culture, whatever is there in Christian culture, ritual, is from the Celts. Because it is pagan. Just like we're Hindu by religion and Vaishnava by philosophy. You know what I'm saying? while Christianity means you're pagan by religion and you're monotheistic by philosophy. Yeah. It means otherwise, well, where are their rituals from? The rituals are not mentioned in the Torah. And there's no ritual mentioned in the New Testament. Right? So where are they from? They're just, all they did was use their pagan rituals. So that's the real funny thing, is that the Christians go all over the world to save the pagans, but they themselves are pagans. You know, they say pagan dress and pagan this, pagan that. I mean, since when is a three-piece suit, Christian? Or, I don't think, what is the saying? Cortez and those guys, they went around and destroyed all these cultures. Who was the other? Cortez, was it Pizarro, who was the other guys? Who was the guy that did the Incas thing? Incas?
Cortez.
That was Cortez.
Spanish.
Well, I thought he did the Aztecs.
Yeah,
whatever it is. But they go around and save. Now, you can tell me a big, huge monster hat with a feather sticking out of it and a funny little mustache and wearing your mother's tights and shoes with little lace and with little bows on them, and knickers, that's Christian. You know what I'm saying? If it's Christian, I don't see the Pope wearing it. But what Jesus wore is what everybody else wore. They all wear it because that was, You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole point, is that these things are made for those who are non-Vedic. So God consciousness is there, culture is there, but it's not as developed. So therefore you can appreciate someone's refined, someone's truthful, someone's honest, someone's hard-working. So, because these principles of sub-religious, that's common. You can teach that to everybody. Right? But actual higher principles of religion, that you have to be very careful. Because they're very subtle. They contain sub-religion, but their purpose is actually higher. Just to be good is not good enough. Being good because it pleases the Lord, that's the reality. That makes sense. Okay. So that's there. Anyone, someone who's an artist can appreciate art. Someone who's a musician can appreciate music. Like that. Someone who's knowledgeable can appreciate knowledge. Means that they actually are them. If they're a real musician, they appreciate music wherever it comes from, if it's good. And it has some basis. Same like that. So. The point is that basis is what God has given. Right? God has given what is music, what is dance, what is art, what is dress, what is culture, what is language, what is food, like this. So the closer it is to that, then you'll see the more sophisticated it is. Right? In Europe, they would bring spices from India. So that was considered high class. Using Indian spices. Like in the West, they eat black pepper and all that, and India uses chili. That's the funny thing. Black pepper is the Indian thing, and the chili is the European thing. Right? I think the Portuguese got chilies from South America, right? And they imported it into India. Somehow or another, the chili's taken over. Right? And the Europeans, because they had nothing over there, then they got their hands on black pepper, which is very exotic. And that's now that state is the standard. So that's, sometimes it's really, really funny how these things work out. Like they were doing a thing on corn. Right? The corn comes from, this maize, which comes from, I think, South America. But then they checked, because now they have all this DNA, and they checked the strains, and they found out that the South American corn that came back to India, I think 2,000 years ago, originally came from India. So that's the fun thing. It's here, and somehow or another it gets lost from here. Or it doesn't become prominent. It becomes prominent somewhere else, and then it comes back. Like the Hare Krishna movement. So it starts from here, and then it gets kind of lost, and then it has to come back from the West. And then people, oh, okay, this is nice. Good thing. Let him eagerly follow the customs which are auspicious and the rule of good conduct. Be careful of purity and control all his organs. Let him mutter prayers and untired daily offer oblations in the fire. Okay, customs which are auspicious and the rule of conduct. In other words, you have the rule, and then you have the custom means the application of that rule. That's one way of looking at it. Another is customs means tradition. Actually, let's put it this way. You have the Shastra, which means you have the Veda. Then from the Veda you have, that's Shruti. Then you have the Smriti, which is tradition. Right? Then you have customs, means how the saintly persons, how they apply the first two. Like that. So therefore then let him follow those customs which are auspicious and they follow the rule of good conduct. In other words, they're based on the tradition, and the customs that are there. If it works, then it's great. Careful of purity, as we mentioned in the beginning, control all his organs. So you can see it's very similar to the first one. Subduing his passions by austerity, wearing white garments, keeping himself pure. Right? Controlling all his organs, careful of purity. Mutter prayers, here studying the Veda. And entirely daily offer oblations in the fire, performance of sacrifice. So sacrifice and japa, then these are considered the prominent things. So that means japa and Harinam Sankirtan. So that's the oblations in the fire and the Sankirtan Yajna. Let him without tiring daily mutter the Veda at the proper time, for they declare that to be one's highest duty. All other observances are called secondary duties. So studying of the Veda, that is the highest. You know, studying the scriptures. And then for us, we even go beyond this into the preacher. That's the next natural thing. Because the Brahman, he has to study it. If he doesn't study it, he's not going to be able to teach it. What you speak is based on what you read. That's why Prabhupada was always insisting that devotees read. Because by reading, then they have something to speak about. So that's why he must study. Because you see, someone who always is studying, whenever they speak, then it's new, it's fresh, it has new angles and that. Because it's like, you know, how many times we ourselves have had the experience, we've heard other devotees talk about it, that they haven't read the Gita for so many years, and when they read it, it's like they're reading a new book. You know, they've heard it all, but a completely new understanding, new angles of vision, new realizations. Like that. So if that's there, it's alive. As long as one is studying, then one can teach. When one stops studying, then teaching becomes less. At the same time, as teaching is one's study also. Because when you teach, people ask questions. You have to think about it. So you have to analyze and study the topic. But because you know the topic like that, then you have the ability to study the topic. While someone else is just learning the topic so they can begin to study it. You understand? That's why actually the teacher learns more than the student. Because the teacher knows the topic and now he's going in and refining it, deepening his understanding. While the student is just starting to learn to know the topic that he can start to think within the field. That's why teaching is so... That's why in the Vedic culture, the Vedic educational system is that the older students teach the younger. Because you learn from who's above you and you teach it to who's below you. Then you're learning, you're progressing in you're broadening your field at the same time as you're deepening what you already know of the field by teaching it. So those two have to go together. So this whole idea is that you go until, you know, after 20 years of education, then you can get a degree that you can start teaching. But then the point is you may not have paid attention. So you may or may not be a great teacher. You know, if you think about it, you think about, you know, the karmi teachers that you've had, you know, and in however many years you spent, 12 years, 20 years or more, how many of them do you remember? Right? And you only remember the ones that were, remember favorably, of course. means that it's because they were good teachers. They actually could get the point across. They were nice people. You liked them. They liked you. They interacted. How many were there? So that's the point. So even they do that doesn't make them a good teacher. Because if a student doesn't remember the teacher, it means they weren't a good teacher. Right? Because the relationship with the teacher is a lifelong relationship. It doesn't end when you graduate. Right? Just like when you grow up and get married, it doesn't end your relationship with your parents. It's a lifelong thing. So the same with the teachers, lifelong. So if you don't remember them, it means they weren't a good teacher. They didn't impress you. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I've heard a lot of teachers when they actually do the assisting teaching in the classroom, they pick up something else. But if you've been doing it since you're 5-6 years old, then you know how to handle. It means you're doing it 5-6 years old, you can handle a 5-6 year old. And then when you're teaching, you're 8, you're teaching 5-6. You know, it means as you move up, you've taken all the ages. So by the time you're in your 20s, you know, you've taught everything, even university level. You've taught everything, up to PhD. By whatever is your degree, you've taught everything below that. So for you, it's very easy. You just walk in the classroom and there's no question, there's no control. Just by walking in, the kids already figured out, okay, we don't mess with this person. It's just that simple. Or if they didn't figure it out because they're, you know, too new at the thing, then, you know, a few words and a few comments and then everybody knows, okay, we don't mess with this thing. Yeah. I had one teacher who was telling me. He walked into the classroom, one of the kids said, you know, because it was a new teacher, he says, I've had so many teachers, you know, always changing. And the teacher who walked in just looked at him straight in the eye and says, we've just met your last one. And the kid just, okay. And from that time on, he was a good student. Otherwise, the thing is, it's fun for them to see how quickly can we get rid of this guy, you know. So they just tell him, hey, I'm here. Says, I'm here. You want to leave and go visit the principal? Says, oh, no, I'm okay. Okay, great. We have an understanding here. Okay, so that is that. Everything else is based on that. All duties are based on the Veda. You don't study the Veda, how do you know your duties? Right? So if you don't study the scriptures, everything's based on that. You don't know the Gita, everything's based on that. All of our activities, our mentality, how it is based on the Gita, it's based on Bhagavatam, it's based on Nectar Devotion, it's based on Chaitanya Charitamrita. We don't know that, then how do we know how to perform our duties? How do we preach? So therefore, that's why it's considered the highest duty. Like that. Because that's, in other words, this is Dharma Shastra, so it situates you in your duty. So therefore this is. We know of all the things you can do, then preaching is better. That's why it says of all charity means, then he says austerity, charity. What is it? Austerity, charity, and something should never be given up. You can never remember the three. So whenever you have a list, you always know all of them but the last one. If it's 5, you know 4. If it's 10, you know 9, right? You know, if it's only 1, then you don't remember it. Right? So, austerity, charity, and penance. These three, even a elevated person doesn't give up. So austerity then is study for a Brahmin is studying the Veda. Charity is giving the Veda. That's the highest. The highest austerity is studying the Veda. The highest charity is giving the Veda. So it still matches for us. It's still Gita. So by performing the austerity gives you result, prosperity. That prosperity must then be given away in charity. So the prosperity you get by your austerity of studying the Veda is knowledge. That knowledge then is given away in charity. Does that make sense? So that's So therefore, we have no contradiction with these. That's why the Prabhupada always talks data culture, data culture, data culture. Because we have no contradiction with this. We have no problem. It just is mimamsa, is how you interpret it. Just because one doesn't know the words or how to connect it and then just say, oh, we don't care for all this. No, no, we care for this. We say exactly the same thing. We just use much more straightforward language because we're not trying to impress somebody to follow karma conduct. We're trying to get them to give that up and now perform activities for Krishna. But the culture is still there. We still follow. We're not jnanis who give it all out and forget it. Then it's easy. That's easy. Karma is easy. You just work, you get your result. The other is, we don't work because we don't want the result. But bhakti is hard to understand because we work, but we're not for the result. Right? No one works except for result. That's why unless you have the goal of the result is pleasing Krishna, then you won't endeavor properly. Or you'll be easily distracted from your endeavor. Does that make sense? Someone's going along in their sentiment, and then they run into some karmi who makes a comment, or some devotee disturbs them, or something, bang, they give up their devotional service because it's sentiment. They're not fixed in the philosophy. They don't know so much what they're doing. So because of that, they give it up. But if they have that long-term goal, I'm doing this to please Krishna, so many obstacles may come, this and that. Therefore, I'm working, but not for the result of being famous or being well-received or taken care of or this or that or getting something. You know. So it's the long-term. It's that I see I'm doing this for Krishna. Because I'm doing it for Krishna, therefore then, all these things then all match with that. Does that make sense? Yeah, I guess this just keeps going. Oh, I'm just going to stop in the past. Okay. Any questions on this? Yeah, there is a different culture. Everywhere you go, different food, different dress, different this, different value system. You know? Like you get one place, it's like... it's just like one place you... It's so different. You know? You eat this, and then if you... that's considered good, and other things are maya. Another place you eat that, and, oh, you mean, don't be fanatic. You know? And, you know, it's just, you can't win. You know? How you dress, place to place... Because we haven't accepted our culture. To some degree, yes. But not as fully as we can to make it consistent where there would be a common culture amongst the devotees that therefore would hold them together as a community. Because how you can tell is that the community is not strong because there's not a common value system. You know? In the early days, it was a common value system. Didn't matter what temple you went to, where you went, it was the same. I don't know about other places, but in America, every temple you went to smelled the same, even. Because they were super clean, right? Super clean, so then you didn't have any extraordinary odors in there. And they all had, you know, the basement full of spiritual sky incense. And they all cooked with ghee. So the combination of the ghee and the incense, you know, every temple smelled like that. And it didn't matter which temple you went to, you were home. So you go there, you go to your temple commander, get some service, do it. It's not your temple, but you go and you do service for them. I remember we were traveling, we stopped at one temple, and then because we were there for 2 days, a few days, then the temple commander gave everybody work. I remember I was going out collecting door to door for that temple, not for our temple. You know, we went out and like that. So, you know, somebody who knew cooking did that, the jars out with puja, others didn't know, they did cleaning or this or that or... So it's just, you just did that. You were there for a few, you just did service. So the point is you always do service, so it doesn't matter what temple you do your service. You know, there's no such thing as holiday or this or that. It's just didn't exist in those days. It just didn't have. You just, everybody did. So you had a common value, so everybody was together. Because there was a common culture there. It may have been very simple, the culture, but it was the same. Everyone ate the same. Everyone had the same menu in the temple. Everyone dressed the same. Everyone, you know, it was all the same. You know. Yeah, it's far out though. You go to India anywhere, it's all the same. Poorest house, the mood that they'll serve you is the same as if you're in the richest house. You know? Like that. It doesn't matter, the mood's the same. Anything else? No. Okay, so then we'll continue on fighting. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.